10 past, so I'm Anthony Asher. My pleasure to welcome you and introduce Martin Hickling, who has worked in investments for 20 years or more, CFA, fellow of FINCIA, as well as being an actuary, started at Colonial Investment Management. Was it called Colonial in those days?
Yeah.
Right, there it was. Okay. In Melbourne, moved to Sydney, sell side with Ord Minnett, JP Morgan, and then with Credit Suisse. And 10 years ago, moved to the buy side. What's the dark side? Is it the buy side or the dark?
The sell side,
the kind of the light side, as a portfolio manager for Concord Capital, which he has worked for until last year. So can I just ask sort of for Martin, well, maybe Martin wants to ask, but how many of you are familiar with Austrian economics? Oh, okay, so a couple. And all right, you've got at least a humble, if not an ignorant audience. And modern monetary theory? All right, two as well. So, right, we'll be interested in hearing what Martin has to say, and he intends to leave a fair amount of time at the end for questions and arguments.
Okay, well, thank you all for attending the session today. It's good to see everyone here. I suppose how I came across this was probably over the last 3 or 4 years, really trying to better understand economies and particularly what it means for investment markets and trying to better understand particularly the financial services industries, including the banking sector. And I suppose through this, we go forward.
Yeah. Which button? Down, on the right.
Oh, down. Okay, got it.
Sorry, just use this one.
Oh.
Right.
Sorry, do you want to carry on?
Yeah, okay. So that led me basically back to the basics of trying to understand how the economy works and looking for different theories, particularly given the current the sort of predominant Keynesian economic theory doesn't seem to have been doing a particularly good job. So trying to look out for how things best should be structured. And I suppose through that I came across the reading of the Austrian economic school. And what I'd like to go through today is basically some of the fundamentals of what that means, in particularly for money. And I suppose we all think of money as cash that we have in we get paid, cash we have in the bank account, and cash we spend purchasing goods and services as well. And not many of us think about actually what money is. Or really the fundamentals of it, and certainly I never come across this concept of sound money or non-sound money, and understanding what sound money is until the last couple of years. So I suppose I'd like to run through those today, and particularly looking at what implications that might have for sort of key actuarial assumptions, which would obviously be things like wage price inflation and asset market forecasts. Thank you. So we go back to the initial basics of money. And so money derives... Well, initially you have a barter system where you have a direct exchange from one good to another, which is basically a subsistence economy. And in that type of economy, there's no need for money, because the goods are interchanged between the two parties. The trouble with that is it's not a very efficient type of economy. Then what you need to improve the efficiency of that economy is developing a medium of exchange so that you don't have to individually barter a good from one person. Instead, you have a medium of exchange. And then over time, that medium exchange can really be anything that the society may decide to be at that case. And we've had wool and grain and other types of medium exchange. But eventually one medium exchange will become more predominant, and that eventually becomes money. And the medium exchange is transferred from the consumer, the person who's buying it, to the person who's producing. But obviously to get the money or the medium exchange in the first place, you've got to have produced something to receive that money. And probably the big benefit of indirect exchange is that it allows for specialisation of labour. So it allows for the division of labour and therefore higher productivity. The only function of money is the medium of exchange. So the money itself takes on the roles only as a medium of exchange, not as some other good or service. And that's sort of important to understand. It's only really there for allowing later acts of interpersonal exchange. Okay. Unlike any other good or service in the economy, where if we're producing more goods and services, that's beneficial for society. There's no that having increased money doesn't create a benefit for society, because it just uses this medium of exchange. Any increase in the money supply will lower the price of money, so it lowers the purchasing power of the money, of the holders of money, and they're the people who have received the money because they've produced something in the first place that the consumer has purchased off them. So if the money that they hold is devalued in wealth, in value, in purchasing power, you can see that's effectively a sort of form of property theft, where they've produced something and got money for it, but now that money is no longer able to buy what it previously could. You come then to the concept of demand for money, which is sort of somewhat a strange thing to think about, but it's basically how much people want to hold as a store of as a store for future purchases, and that's effectively what the demand for money is. Obviously, that's different to the demand for wealth, which is obviously people want to become wealthier, but this is how much money you want to actually hold in your account. When there's a high demand for money, then market prices of goods and services tend to fall. And when there's a low demand of money, because you don't want the money you're actually spending on goods and services, the prices tend to rise. In terms of monetary calculation, which is basically profit and loss, that's seen as, from the Austrian Economic School, as basically a foundation of action under the social system. So if you can't actually work out if something is the right, well, if you, the monetary calculation is the way you can try and work out if something is the right way to do it, or if it's the most productive way to go about organising your system. Okay, with new money coming to the system, I suppose I previously had the view that new money came in the system as inflation, all prices went up equally, so therefore nothing was changed particularly, other than I suppose you could say that the people holding money had a reduction in their purchasing power. But the Austrian Economic School shows that when the new money comes in, it's often uneven and non-transparent. So the people who receive the money earlier, whether they be paid through the government or they be part of the banking sector or whatever, they receive the money, and the things that they purchase first, the prices of those affected, and then only second or third round prices of other goods affected. So, and by an unnatural injection of the new money, because prices are distorted, that leads to misallocation of capital and therefore the business cycle, stream business cycle. It's also, I suppose, it's something which was new to me as well, which was inflation. I suppose I always thought that inflation was just changes in the CPI, and I suppose that's what most of us get taught. But the traditional or the classical definition of inflation is actually changes in the money supply rather than changes in the consumer price index. So the consumer price index is one indicator of inflation, but it itself is not inflation. This demand for money can have an impact on that inflation, so therefore it's actually very difficult to actually measure inflation because of that, but that doesn't actually take away from the theoretical value that it's really the supply of money which is changing the inflation, adjusting for how people want to demand money. Probably another area of insight is that inflation doesn't just affect prices of goods and services, it also affects asset prices. So increases in the money supply might affect prices for goods and services, but also might affect asset prices, equities, property, bonds. And how that increases in money supply is split between those two areas is something which is very hard or basically impossible to predict. So sometimes it'll have a greater impact on goods and services, and particularly that's in the time where people will have less faith in the purchasing power being maintained of money, and other times it will find it into asset prices. And the consequences of the new money supply and the distorted prices is that because monetary calculation becomes erroneous, scarce resources, which is what economic theory is all about, how scarce resources are allocated, they are erroneously allocated, and therefore customer needs and ends are not met as well as they otherwise would be. If you look at money supply in Australia and elsewhere around the world, it's pretty clear that we're seeing large increases in the money supply. Since December 1971, if you go back then, Australia had a currency base of, which is basically notes and coins, of $1.5 billion. And at the end of 2012, it had grown to $53.8 billion. So we certainly had big increases in money supply. Over the same period, M3, which includes term and other deposits with banks, has risen from $17 billion to $1.5 trillion. So it's up 89 times, so even more so. And what I find quite remarkable is even just the last 5 years, during what's been pretty tough economic times around the world, Australia, M3 has increased by a bit over $530 billion or 9% compound. So I think it's in the order of 50% increase over that period. One thing which we might want to talk about later, and I'll maybe get some questions on, with the money supply increasing so quickly, why hasn't that fed through as much to consumer price index inflation? Where money supply the last 20 years is up about 9.6%, but the CPI is only up 2.7%. So we can talk about some of the issues maybe involved in that in the question time. Okay, then you've seen that money supply increases substantially, but I suppose you're then coming to understand why the money supply increases so substantially. When you think in a free market, the holders of money really don't want their money to be depleted in terms of purchasing power. So in that type of market, you would be quite happy with a 0% change in money supply. So the reason why, however, we do have large increases in money supply, and even under something like a gold standard or some other standard, you still get new supply coming to the marketplace. But you have, two factors. One, the government, where they're financing government deficit spending other than through raising funds through the private sector, so where they're selling financing themselves through the banking sector. And the second one is fractional reserve banking. And And just to explain the theory behind that is where... So fractional reserve banking basically depends on how much deposits we have, the banks have to hold at the central bank, which we probably all learned a bit about that when we were studying. But the concept of fractional reserve banking is when someone deposits some money in a bank as a deposit, then that money is then on lent elsewhere. And because not everyone will come back and ask for their money at the one time, the banks can run more supply of money than would otherwise be the case. So effectively, the banks act as money producers when they're granting credit through the issue of fiduciary media. So in other words, where they're issuing through that are not covered by reserves or by money, sorry. Okay, the provision of credit through fiduciary media, which is again where it's not backed by money, can really only be done by banks where they're of sufficient scale so that you won't get a bank run effectively, so everyone doesn't come back and ask for their money at the one time. The more fiduciary media that's issued in the marketplace, the better for the banks, because obviously they can earn more interest margins on that. So, but the banking sector is quite incentivised to issue as much credit as possible, but not so much that the creditors may lose confidence or the depositors might lose confidence in those banks. So here, the central banks as the lender of last resort, and also governments, particularly providing deposit guarantees, become quite important components in allowing banks to issue the fiduciary media. Okay, then we get on to the various risk factors which I've identified. The first one is consumer price index risk. So I haven't called inflation risk because, again, inflation is driven more from money supply than the consumer price index. I suppose the first point here is that, as I mentioned before, the CPI has been half or less than half of the increase in the money supply in Australia. So we haven't really seen the money supply coming through as much into the prices of goods and services as we have had the money supply going elsewhere. But that's not to say that that may not reverse in the future. And obviously the key factor there is the confidence of the public in the quality and the purchasing power of the money that they're holding in their bank deposits and in just cash holdings. I suppose the big risk here would be if people do come to that realisation that their nominal assets are going to be inflated away and therefore at risk, then they'll move those nominal assets into more real assets and tangible assets, or even just into holding goods for the sake of holding goods rather than holding cash. And that's obviously the main risk for the CPI. If we look at wages and wage rate risk, probably the key point here, and you hear it with most people you talk to in most companies anyhow, about how high Australian wage rates are and issues of competitiveness relating to that. In an unhampered market, you should quite easily see that wage rates are reflected basically on the level of capital investment, both in capital itself but also in skill development, and those wage rates should reflect that. So potentially that is the case in Australia, that the high wage rates are reflective of those factors. But we also need to take into the possibility that high wage rates have been driven by excessive consumption. And basically, if you know, a large supply of money supply makes it more difficult for savers or reduces the purchasing power. So that tends to lead to consumption over capital formation. And if we have had this period of excessive consumption, and Australian housing stock might be an example of that, that malinvestment going forward may well get realised. And in that case, we will be worse off because we've invested our capital in less productive areas than we would have otherwise have been the case. And I suppose, you know, an example of that is, well, of credit expansion in terms of affecting prices of goods and services, that is that nominal wages go up, but real wages go up less than nominal wages, which is actually what we're seeing in the US. We haven't really seen that in Australia so far. But so everyone feels like they're wealthy because their nominal wages are going up. But, you know, example is, you know, anyone who hasn't got into the housing market now comes along and looks to buy a house, they're obviously incredibly expensive. So you're not necessarily better off from the you know, increase in the money supply which we've seen. In terms of asset price risks, as I mentioned before, inflation and increasing the money supply generates forces that tend towards capital consumption over capital accumulation. And also, inflation understates the costs of depreciation because obviously what you purchased the capital goods at previously and is not the sort of true cost in current monetary terms, and that creates this phenomenon of imaginary or apparent profits for companies, which again makes it much more difficult for doing asset valuations. And also distortions of interest rates, which clearly we've seen around the world at the moment with central banks having such low interest rates, also creates further distortions of capital markets and your ability to discount cash flows based on you know, an appropriate rate of interest, as it's not a freely determined rate of interest rather than it's a rate of interest determined through the central banks. Then we get on to the risk of currency debasement, and this is where the Austrian theory, Mises, is one of the sort of key authors behind Austrian economic theory, and he argues through that theory that the recurrence of periods of boom which are followed by depression is the unavoidable attempts of repeated again and again to lower the gross market of interest by credit expansion. And either you can step away from that, which, you know, has been done in the past occasionally but rarely, or you come to the case of a final and total catastrophe of the monetary base, which is basically people giving up in terms of their assessment of fiat or paper money, which is something we have seen historically. I suppose the most interesting part at the moment is that around the world, pretty much every single country is running a government fiat paper money system, so you haven't got a hard currency to depreciate against. Move on to the next one, which is implications for actuarial assumptions. And so firstly, risk-free bonds. Well, I suppose we've seen in some countries, particularly, say, Greece, they haven't been as risk-free as you might have otherwise thought so. But I suppose the key things to consider that is how the state is able to repay you the money from the bonds. And there's basically two ways: through either taxing the populace going forward or by monetising the debt through an increase in the money supply. So obviously that puts you exposed to you know, risks in terms of real returns from domestic investors and foreign exchange risk for international investors in bonds. In terms of CPI, I suppose the key lesson here is that CPI is really a measure of inflation, but it's not inflation itself. So when you're looking at inflationary risks, you really should be looking at money supply growth and where that money supply growth is going, either into goods and services inflation or into asset price inflation. And the third one would be under Austrian economic theory, shows that the current system we have is now unsound money, and therefore these inflationary consequences are pretty much in train. And obviously that's fine if you've got real assets and real liabilities, but not so particularly if you've got nominal assets and real liabilities. And for discussion points, I've got a range here, but I'm sure we'll have others. First one, what are the alternatives? What would a sound money look like? Would it be gold? Would it be silver? Or some of you might have also heard of Bitcoin, which has been in the press quite a bit recently. Second one, you know, we live in a democratic country at the moment now. Why haven't we already got one of these sound money systems if we really wanted to? What would a collapse of the currency look like when everyone has paper money, as I mentioned before? We might have a quick discussion on what assets would perform best if we got a collapse in the paper money system. And then some issues on gold. Is gold effectively an option, or gold price effectively an option on gold becoming money going forward or not? And the last one, which comes from a quote that I've got in the paper, is savings for chumps. Okay, with that, open for questions.
Concerned that this will sort of degenerate into a debate. But can I ask anyone, is anyone else in the audience wanting to enter the debate or have a question at this point? All right, go for it.
Go back to your first slide.
Yep.
The first point that you made. David Graeber has a good book that came out one or two years ago that says the barter or direct exchange economy is actually an economic myth. David Graeber's an anthropologist, and he goes back and takes a look at societies through history and says nowhere did we actually ever have a barter economy. Most economies actually work on the basis of trust. In fact, if you take a look at our closest relatives, chimpanzees, bonobos, and all the rest of it, they actually have an extremely good economy. It's a 100% service-based economy. It's all done on the basis of trust. And basically, David Graeber goes through and shows that how, as economies became more sophisticated, the trust-based economy was actually replaced by a money-based economy, because it became too difficult to remember, well, who scratched my back, and who scratched my back, and I scratched your back, and you scratched hers, and she scratched him, and oh God, I've lost it, who needs to scratch my back now? So you actually get a basis for money flowing from the needs of, well, oh God, that's too hard to remember, look, here's a token. So we've got that tokenistic freedom of money. A number of your other points.
Sorry, can you, yep. do you want to respond?
Yeah,
to
yeah. Well, I suppose on that point, I suppose I would have thought you're sort of agreeing with what I'm saying here, is that like trust would have been the medium of exchange.
No. Trust is the medium of exchange.
Yeah. Forms the medium of exchange, but obviously trust is, again, it tends to be interpersonal. So if you scratch someone else's back, they're going to have to give you something back in equivalent for that. So it's actually not a very good indirect exchange model, because you can't therefore exchange it with lots of other people. So, and I suppose also trust can be broken, which is where a token or something which also has some other commodity value, like gold, has an advantage over that. So basically the concept, again, Austrian economic theory, is that the free market will work out what is the best medium of exchange, And historically, that has come to generally be gold or silver.
Well, except that historically, at the moment, everybody's got a fiat currency because that's what the free market has chosen.
Okay, sorry, Frank, can we go on to that? Sorry, I do have an instruction, in fact, that please go and speak at the microphone and introduce yourself by name and company. Sorry, there are a couple of other comments. We'll come back to you, I'm sure.
Hi, Elaine Grace, Actuaries Institute. I'd just like to get your opinion on the latest Japanese experiment where they're hoping to double the money supply in an effort to increase inflation. Just the kind of general view around town about the impact of that and whether it's a huge experiment or not.
Okay. Well, I think the Japanese have been the first into quantitative easing, have been pretty aggressive at that. And I suppose this all comes down to what's commonly discussed about currency wars at the moment, which is where all countries are trying to devalue their currency to try and be more competitive. And obviously the Japanese are keen to try and create some inflation. Again, I think largely based on Keynesian economic theory that more inflation and more money supply would generate growth. Instead, that's most evidently been seen in yen depreciation, and which is if you think about it, if your currency depreciates, it's basically a decrease in your wealth in terms of the international stage. So it seems to be a pretty bizarre policy to try and decrease the wealth of the individuals within your country. But I think it's largely driven by government and central bank policies, and certainly Austrian economic theory would be very much against that. Austrian economic theory would like to do away with central banks. They'd like interest rates to be set by just by human action, basically by the people determining what's the appropriate interest rate for deferring my consumption to future periods. So certainly from Austrian economic perspective, it has no positives.
Wayne Langton, just a couple of comments. That you've been using money supply, that's a term sort of throughout the presentation. My understanding is that the important aspect about what impact on inflation is actually the velocity of money. And one of the reasons that all of this quantitative easing hasn't actually increased the rate of inflation, let's take the states. I mean, you use Australia, but I mean, the level of borrowing that we've had is minuscule, particularly if you look at it in terms of overseas. But if you look at the states and the level of their borrowings has increased exponentially over the last half dozen years, and they were principally doing that to generate growth in the states. Now, the problem is that the money was being paid into banks, and the banks weren't lending it out. You referred to the way that the bank can actually take a dollar in and basically lend it three times. So if they do that, it increases the velocity of money. What's happening, my understanding, is that the bank takes in a dollar and they set aside the dollar to increase their reserves. So the velocity of money hasn't been actually increasing. The risk that we run is at some stage the banks are going to say, oh, we want to start lending, and the velocity of money is starting to reflect the actual volume of lending that the government has actually done. That's when we actually have a potential for hyperinflation. The other thing, and just referring to the Japanese experiment, I mean, in terms of Japan, I mean, they basically had 20 years of virtually no inflation, no interest rates. So my understanding is that it's generally accepted that a certain level of inflation is in fact attractive and desirable. And one of the reasons that the Japanese government is actually trying to do what they're doing is to generate a certain level of inflation in the country. And in respect of the impact on the currency, my understanding, my reading says very strongly that what that is doing to the Japanese economy is dramatically increasing their competitiveness in terms of overseas markets. And so what they're doing is they're actually exporting a lot more product out of Japan into other countries, and actually taking the exports from particularly Southeast Asia. So it is actually having a beneficial, that the drop in currency is actually having a beneficial effect on the Japanese economy, because they're actually being able to generate more or produce more.
Okay, thanks for those questions. Just firstly, on the velocity of money question. So firstly, I'd say that Australian growth in money supply and consumer credit has actually been stronger than US growth in consumer credit. It's just that Australia came from a bit of a lower base when you do the ratios at start. But actually, the growth in credit's actually been extremely strong in Australia. And Australia's got a very high level of household debt as a percentage of GDP. I think it's up pretty close to the US, but started from low levels, so it's been increasing at a greater rate, but I think it's pretty much there with the US now. But the question is more about velocity of money, which I'm probably not technically strong enough to answer you fully on that, other than, as I understand, the Austrian Economic School is not a really big believer in the velocity of money as a factor on its own. I suppose they see that as an outworking of other factors, and the velocity of money is sort of a final derivation, rather than someone wakes up in the morning and says, "I'm going to increase the velocity of my money today." So it's more of a factor of your demand for money, which I spoke about, and I suppose again how confident you are in the purchasing power of your money going forward. As the money supply feeds into the different areas, I think it's really just depends on those, again, people acting, or human action, which was the name of the Ludwig Mises book, is what's going to really drive where the inflation goes through to, rather than some element of velocity of money in itself. In terms of Japan, I suppose, I've got this as the first bit of the paper in terms of what economic theory is all about. Economic theory is not about looking at the obvious or the first round effects of things, but sort of anyone can work out that. And if there's an incentive, if someone gives you some money and says, you know, go and buy a plasma TV, then it's pretty clear that that's good for the plasma TV providers. They're going to make some money from that, but it's not so obvious that who you've had to tax more to, who won't be purchasing a suit because they've got less money because they've been taxed, or if you've just done it through printing money, the person who had savings, their purchasing power is diminished. So I suppose what I'll say is that some of the factors you spoke about, like the currency depreciation being good for exports, is probably true in a early or short-term sense, but depreciating your currency, you know, makes you worth less going forward, so it seems pretty strange from a long-term point of effect. And I suppose the other factor is that increasing the money supply is effectively a reallocation of capital between different parties as well. So it doesn't make the Japanese economy more productive, but it may just reallocate who owns part of that productive capacity.
Question? Frank, you got another question?
Oh, I don't have any. I don't have any questions.
Point. Debates
and so.
Let me ask a point, and you can make another one. I have a monetary policy debate over Sunday lunch every week with my children. My oldest boy is very into modern monetary theory, and he says that fiat money has value because the government has the right to tax, and therefore, as long as governments retain their right and will to tax, we won't get hyperinflation. What's your response to that?
Oh, I think I'm not sure that's related to hyperinflation. I can understand you can only pay your taxes in paper money, paper fiat money, so therefore you have to have those provided. And if a government like they have previously, outlaws individuals holding gold, like they did in the US. Everyone had to sell back their gold to the government. Or like something like Bitcoin's a good, interesting example now, where people are setting up their own monetary exchange through Bitcoin, so maybe you can do that. But in terms of the risk of hyperinflation, I think that is more driven just by increases in the money supply rather than your ability to a government deciding that you must pay taxes through your paper money.
Sorry, is Frank make a point?
Jonathan Shee, two very quick questions. Firstly, you had a tantalising reference to the catastrophic collapse of the fiat money system, so I'd be interested to hear a little bit about what that looks like. And the second question is whether the growth of metals-based exchange-traded funds, as well as things like Bitcoin, whether you think they're going to change how people think about fiat money.
Sorry, just on the last one, that changed how they...
Whether that might impact the how people view fiat money and the role of fiat money, and whether perhaps that's been a factor in some of the rapid growth of metals-based alternates to holding the physical commodity.
Okay. Maybe I'll take the second one first because that's sort of the easier one, and I probably don't necessarily have a good answer for the first question. I would expect that not many people in the markets. Obviously, there are some gold specialists who do believe Austrian economic theory and specialise in gold and gold funds because of that, and see gold as a prospective money going forward. But my guess is that most of the participants in the market don't see gold as money in the future. They just see it as having historical relevance and potentially some store of value and potentially some negative correlations with other markets. So I think that's probably why most of the money went into the gold ETFs. We've actually seen a big outflow of gold ETFs, which wouldn't make sense if people really seen it, because nothing's really changed in terms of government fiat money story over the last 6 months or so. It's really just been maybe a bit more of an economic recovery view, and people saying, well, why do I need to hold gold as a hedge if the economy is recovering? So I think that's predominantly why gold's held. Bitcoin's probably a different question, because Bitcoin is a sort of a non-state distributed system. I think sort of probably of a lot of interest to sort of IT, anarchist type people who prefer that government got out of their way. So it's probably I think the market got up to $1.5 billion market size, so it's quite potentially a big market. But maybe some of the concepts and ideas behind it, but I don't think we even know who really set it up, so hasn't necessarily got that coming through. But maybe some of those ideas might flow on to people questioning a bit more of what is government fiat paper money, and is that something that I want to hold? And maybe I suppose that's where the currency collapse comes into it. And I suppose probably the best all I can do is look at historical examples of paper money collapse. And in the paper I've got the study of the Weimar German Republic, which is a fascinating book. I'd certainly recommend everyone had a chance to read. It's pretty easy read and just amazing to understand what can happen to a currency. And probably that's the best example I can give rather than speculate myself.
Richard?
Richard Lyon, PFS. I'm glad you mentioned the Weimar Republic, because that led to the rise of a very notorious Austrian. aren't we still in the same space as Frank and his bonobos and other apes, and it's all about trust? It's all about, I trust that the paper or the electrons, whatever it is actually going to deliver me what I want to spend it on when the time comes. And as soon as that trust disappears, that's when you get excessive inflation, hyperinflation, panic, run on the bank, whatever the actual manifestation might be. And we've seen that in individual currencies to some degree or other. We've seen hyperinflation where the safe haven is a foreign currency, and there are restrictions on foreign exchange to try and counter that. So the value of the American dollar in South American countries during their periods of high inflation, for example. That tantalizing vision that a previous speaker mentioned is the one of the whole world's fiat system falling apart. And I'm struggling with that because there has to be some kind of base to bring it back to, and there has to be a collapse that either the domino just keeps going or it something happens to make it all happen at once. And I just wonder what the Austrian theory has in it that's saying this is going to happen, other than, well, if I build my theory like this, I've got something that's unsustainable, and because it's unsustainable, it inevitably must collapse. And that doesn't go far enough for me, because I need to know what's going to do that, and what's there an absence of to halt the collapse.
Okay, so I suppose what could stop a collapse would be governments agreeing around the world to restrict growth in the money supply through linking to not necessarily the gold standard, but some sort of what they call inelastic commodity currency, which you're not going to get increases in supply from. And I suppose the probability of that is probably somewhere between 0 and 5%, and probably closer to the 0% type range. I suppose it's very difficult because, as you'd say, government control over paying of tax through paper fiat money, and people have become so used to paper fiat money. If you went back 100 years ago, classical liberal people understood the concept of sound money, but I at least had never even heard of the concept until a couple of years ago. So, but I suppose once people understand the concept of free money, history has shown that people prefer a sound money. So the person who's received the money would prefer that they didn't lose purchasing power for that money, and in a free market, people have chosen other things rather than paper money or digital money. I suppose that's one thing with Bitcoin. I suppose if you've got any back of mind, at the moment they're increasing the number of Bitcoins, but there is a finite limit. Who's to say, because it is just electronic, that someone won't find some way to hack into the program and suddenly double the amount of Bitcoin's an issue. Same with gold, right? People say there's tons of gold on Mars. We can go up and mine the gold on Mars, then suddenly there'd be huge supply, and gold would not be the appropriate medium of exchange for people to use. But the Austrian economic theory says leave it to the free market. So take it away from governments, leave it to the free market, and for people through their individual actions to decide how they want to hold their wealth.
Frank, quick point.
Actually, two bits of history lessons.
Maybe the microphone.
Into the microphone.
Two history lessons. The free market decided that it didn't want to have gold, and we can take a look at the late 19th century in the US, where we had presidential elections run on saying, we don't want farmers and small people crucified on the cross of gold, that famous speech. The people who wanted the gold standard at that point of time were the bankers, because, and the robber barons, because they were expropriating the wealth. They were the 1% taking from the 99%. And you can also see The Wizard of Oz, which is an allegory on the bimetallism and the whole idea of that whole political stream. Secondly, Weimar Germany didn't lead to the rise of Adolf Hitler. Weimar Germany, the hyperinflation there lasted for 6 months. It happened because the French marched into the Ruhr as part of the Versailles Treaty, took away about a quarter of the German productive capacity. The government tried to stop income dropping by 25% by printing money. They got onto a roller coaster for 6 months. At the end of it, they said, "This is stupid. We've dropped everything by 25%. We've cut our income, and we're going to live on that now. End of story." What actually happened, what brought Adolf Hitler to power, was actually the Great Depression, which Adolf Hitler actually stopped. And we're not allowed to talk about this, but by taking Keynesian economics in Germany, he actually stopped the Great Depression in Germany pretty much very quickly, one of the quickest turnarounds. But we're not allowed to talk about that. Because he did some other very, very bad things. That's not in praise of Adolf Hitler. It's just,
okay, Frank, can I
just two history lessons.
Thank you. Okay, Martin, do you want to respond very quickly to that?
Yeah, okay, very quickly.
You've got exactly 60 seconds.
I didn't actually mention Adolf Hitler as part of the theme, but certainly from history, the one that I'd really suggest is when money dies, the nightmare of deficit spending, devaluation, and hyperinflation in Weimar Germany by Adam Ferguson. It's a very good read. And I suppose just the question on the farmers in the US and going off the gold standard, I suppose that's one. That may be the case in a democracy where people say we want to move into paper money rather than gold, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do to move off a sound money standard for those people who hold the money in the system.
Okay, I won't get you to respond again, but I think thank you. I think that was very good. Okay.